Hey y'all, I'm your co-host Marisha Malcolm, and I'm joined by the wonderful Abigail Franks. In the South, specifically in the Appalachian region, many coal workers and coal ash workers are facing dangerous conditions and do not have proper protections from the federal and business levels. As coal companies begin to shut down due to it being a dying industry and our need to sustainably transition, how do we make sure these people are taken care of? Today, we're going to talk to two Appalachian leaders who are fighting for these communities.
Climate justice, y'all. It's real, it's here, and it's about time we listen to folks like Willie Dodson and Bree Nisley from Appalachian Voices, who endlessly work on the policy and local levels in Virginia and Tennessee to protect workers in their communities. Welcome, let's get started with the show.
All right, hi everyone. I just wanna go ahead and let's get started. You know, the first question being, can you guys introduce yourself and Appalachian Voices?
Yeah. sorry, I'm laughing because y'all are saying Appalachian.
Well, okay, I usually say Appalachian or Appalachian.
We definitely say Appalachian. But it's all correct. It's all correct. My own brother says Appalachian.
Yeah. Oh, man.
My name is Willie Dodson, and I'm the Central Appalachian Field Coordinator for Appalachian Voices. I'm based out of our Southwest Virginia office in Norton, Virginia, and I work across the region, mostly in Virginia and West Virginia, on mine reclamation issues and some environmental issues. But a lot of what I work on, especially over the last couple of years, has had to do with black lung disease and supporting coal miners who are disabled with black lung disease at organizing and building power in their communities and exercising that power to influence public policies that affect them.
And my name's Bree Nisley. I'm our Tennessee campaign manager for Appalachian Voices, and I work in our energy democracy program. I'm based in Knoxville, Tennessee. We're in the Tennessee Valley Authority footprint, which is our big federal utility that was formed here back in the 30s, a New Deal project, and it provides electricity for Tennessee and parts of six surrounding states. TVA, you know, I look at TVA sort of as a union stronghold in a right to work region. TVA has 10,000 annual employees and around 11,000 employees that they contract for specific projects in any given year. And there are 17 different unions that represent many or maybe most of TVA's workers, both annually and contract. And so, you know, workers are a big part of the TVA story, and environmental groups, and particularly Appalachian Voices, we've been working really hard to build connections with labor over the last several years. And, you know, that's kind of happened through different routes. We've been working a lot with coal ash workers who were impacted by the Kingston coal ash spill of 2008, which I can talk about more later. And we've also been working with communities who are dealing with coal ash and trying to figure out how to make sure the storage of that coal ash is safe as TVA closes its remaining fossil plants. We've also been doing a little bit of work with unions who have faced worker outsourcing at TVA, and I can talk about some more of that later too. But those are kind of the labor issues that we work around. And more broadly, you know, Appalachian Voices is sort of an environmental energy focused nonprofit. We work around just transition issues broadly. And that description of our organization is probably not up to spec with our comms team, but you know, I don't like to read the mission statement. So
yeah, y'all are doing on the ground work. And so Appalachian, now I'm gonna say Appalachian. I see Willie laughing at me right now. Appalachian. I grew up in the like foothills of the Appalachian Mountains, and I was always told it's Appalachian. But anyway, so y'all are from like Tennessee, like to Virginia, right? Or like what all territories do y'all cover?
Our organization works in Tennessee, Kentucky, Virginia, West Virginia, and North Carolina. And in Virginia and North Carolina, we have quite a lot of work over in the Piedmont regions. Those aren't programs that Bree and I work on. In West Virginia and Kentucky, our work is limited to the coal-bearing parts of the state. And in Tennessee, it's a little bit more broad because of all of Bree's work in various partnerships on like utility oversight and stuff like that.
Neat. Okay, so Bree, you kind of mentioned this a little bit. Both Bree and Willie mentioned this a little bit earlier, but since this is an episode about labor, and like y'all said, y'all work a lot with coal miners and coal ash workers, can y'all describe a little bit of the labor issues that y'all see? I mean, Bree, you mentioned the Kingston ash of 2008, and for like, I only know a little bit about that, but if y'all could please elaborate on the issues that these workers face, that would be awesome, starting with Willie and then going to Bree.
Sure. I mean, there's innumerable issues affecting workers in the region, but I can speak to the issues that I work on, and that has to do with black lung. So black lung disease happens when coal miners breathe in coal and silica dust, and the dust builds up in their lungs and becomes concretized basically in their lungs, and it impairs their ability to breathe. So you hear stories from these miners about, like, one of the ones that I hear a lot of miners talk about is just how they can't play with their grandkids anymore. And these,
oh gosh,
you know, anecdotes about the grandbaby saying, oh, granddaddy, you know, chase me or whatever. And they just can't because they can't breathe, you know, with physical exertion. Other ways I've heard people describe how it impacts their lives is just, you know, having trouble just bringing the groceries into the house. Or this one buddy of mine has a pretty small yard and he can't mow it in one go. And you know, and a lot of these guys, they're tough coal miner men, and they have a real kind of attitude of what it's supposed to be a man, you know, and I've heard some people really struggling with that too, you know, that they can't provide for their families in these ways. But so anyway, black lung is on the rise right now, particularly in Appalachia. And that's because the thicker and more quality seams of coal have pretty well been mined out already. So the seams of coal that's left in the ground that the miners are going to get are these thinner seams of coal. So, I mean, the layer of strata exists in the ground, kind of like you can think of like the little layers of icing in a cake or whatever, you know? And so to get to the coal, they have to cut more and more just rock, sandstone. That's where all this fine respirable silica dust comes from.
Oh, no.
Sometimes they'll do what's called a slope mine, where they have to cut a tunnel down at an angle through sandstone for days or weeks sometimes before they even get to the coal. So they're just in silica dust the whole time. So that's why it's spiking. Now, there's a problem. I'll come back to what I was just about to say, but the rates are spiking, and something else that's happening at the same time is that there's a wave of coal company bankruptcies happening because coal just can't compete anymore with cheaper natural gas and cleaner energy sources. There's a lot of coal that's mined to be used in the smelting of metals, metallurgy, making of steel and stuff. And those markets are hanging on a little bit better. But all of this coal that's been historically used for power generation, that industry is having trouble competing. So these companies are going bankrupt. And the miners who worked for those companies that are going bankrupt can no longer depend on those companies to provide their health care and their disability benefits. The way the law is set up is when a miner is deemed disabled with black lung, then the company that they worked for a period of 1 year is deemed responsible and has to provide the medical care and the disability benefits. But when that company goes bankrupt, then these folks have to depend on the federal government to provide the benefits and the healthcare.
So
go ahead.
I'm kind of like, my blood pressure's rising as we speak. So what I'm hearing is that these companies aren't being held accountable for the disabilities that they have caused for people. Like, You said the company that they worked for a year is the one that's responsible. Why aren't the other companies helping as well? Because I'm assuming it accumulates, right?
Yeah, just the way the law is designed. The law was designed, it just had to put somebody on the hook.
Jesus, yeah.
So that's just the way the law is designed, that it's the last company for which a minor worked for 12 months or more. So, but you're right, that most miners that I know anyway, who have worked a long career in the mines, have worked for multiple companies in the course of their, 20 to 30, 40 years, whatever they've worked underground, but so when these companies go bankrupt, the miners depend on the federal government for the healthcare and the benefits. That is funded through a small tax that the coal companies themselves pay, called the Black Lung Excise Tax. That tax is something that we've been fighting to keep in place for the past few years, because it's only being extended by Congress on little one-year intervals. And at the end of each year, it will revert to a little bit less than 50% of what the current rate is, unless Congress acts to extend it. So what we're pushing for right now is a permanent extension of the tax and to raise the tax rate by 25%. And the reason we're pushing for that is because the current rate is insufficient to cover all of the medical payments and disability benefits that it's intended to fund. And that 25% increase is what has been projected by the Government Accountability Office to be the necessary rate to cover what these miners need. So that's
bored. Yeah.
That's a big issue that we've been working on. And the other thing I'll say about this, to back up to when I was talking about the silica dust, it is legal to expose coal miners to twice the levels of respirable silica dust as it is workers in any other industry. And the reason for that is because occupational hazards in other industries are regulated by OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, but in mines, it's MSHA, the Mine Safety and Health Administration, and they just have different regulations. And for some reason, the MSHA reg is totally insufficient. There's all kinds of studies that show that it's insufficient. And like I say, I could go work in a coal mine for some period of time and then quit that job and go work in like a countertop factory. And when I move over to the countertop factory, I'm protected at twice the level as I previously would have been against silica exposure. So something that partners of Appalachian Voices are working hard on is trying to bring those regulations into parity, to bring the MSHA silica standard down to the same level that applies to workers in every other industry.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like, okay, that's really sketchy, like all around. That's kind of sketchy. I'm going to go down a whole rabbit hole. Well, okay, we'll wait till later. To kind of transition, Bree, can you talk a little bit about some of the labor issues that the coal ash cleanup workers that you work with deal with?
Yep, I'm happy to. And I feel like it kind of brings the story full circle, right? Like Willie's been talking about how they get the coal, and now we're talking about what happens to the coal after it's burned and how the workers handle it. And when I think about, workers handling coal ash, I like to point out that, like, moving and handling and dealing with coal ash is an important part of just transition. So environmental groups who are fighting for climate justice, like, this needs to be on your agenda and something that you're working around. Because one, there are communities who are dealing with coal ash pits and dumps that are leaking and blowing this toxic waste into the air around their communities. And also, like, workers are the ones who are responsible for moving it. And, there's a plant here in Tennessee at Allen, it's called Allen Plant out by Memphis, that closed down recently, and the coal ash is going to be moved from that plant, and they're estimating that it's going to take as many as 8 years to move all of the coal ash there, because there's so much, and that's at one plant. So it's a lot of work, it's a lot of work, and it's part of transition. So it's
I think it's our responsibility to be learning about coal ash, understanding how it impacts communities and workers especially, you know, and again, making that part of our agenda. So I think the way coal ash really got on the radar from a worker safety standpoint is because of the Kingston coal ash spill that happened in 2008. It was the largest industrial disaster in the US. It was like several—
Holy crap.
Yeah, several times the volume of the Exxon spill. I can't remember how many times, but it was just huge. Basically what happened was a dike broke at the, you know, in a, at a dam near Kingston, and a million gallons of coal ash spilled out into the Clinch and Emory Rivers. And it was so forceful that it actually knocked some houses from their foundations when it happened. Huge environmental disaster. Yeah. Really?
That sounds like dystopian and apocalyptic. What the hell?
Yeah. And I think it really was, you know, and after the spill happened on December 22nd, and workers, you know, right around Christmas, and workers were deployed to clean up the spill pretty much the very next day. And what's important to note is, you know, I mentioned before, TVA has a lot of unions that represents their workers. And many of these unions are not only responsible for trying to bring in more members to their unions, but they're also trying to find work for their workers, you know, so they contract with TVA to try to bring in jobs and keep their workers employed. And so when the spill happened, you know, there were a few unions that, you know, had a lot of workers that weren't on jobs at the time that immediately, you know, got employed. It was a years long project. They offered, the job itself offered a lot of really good bonuses right before Christmas, you know, so it put a lot of people to work. Unfortunately, those workers weren't protected. TVA contracted with a company named Jacobs Engineering to bring the workers onto the site. And, you know, there were something like 900 workers that, cleaned up the spill for 6 years. That's how long it took to clean it up. And they weren't protected during the cleanup. They were denied respirators. There are some workers who claim that, you know, they tried to bring respirators on site and they were actually destroyed by their supervisors. They were told the coal ash was, you know, safe enough to eat their lunches on top of, you know, sprinkle it on their food is what they were told. You know, they were told it was completely safe. But coal ash isn't safe. Yeah.
That's absurd. Why would you destroy like things that can, it's, why would you not want to be better safe than sorry? You know, was it like political?
I mean, I think that there's a lot of speculation as to why this happened. And I'll say, you know, there were a lot of agencies at fault for this happening, right? Cause like, I think EPA, OSHA, TVA, Jacobs, you know, I think there's a whole list of folks who had some fault in this happening. And some of this is being figured out in court right now. You know, there's different lawsuits taking place, but some of the speculation is that TVA was concerned that the public, you know, seeing workers at the site of the spill in full protective gear, that it would make people afraid of, you know, the fact that the spill happened and just caused like further blowback. So, I mean, that's one thing that people think is the reason that the workers weren't protected, but you know, they weren't protected. And again, coal ash isn't safe. It contains heavy metals like mercury, cadmium, arsenic, lead, and a whole host of others, depending on where the coal is mined. And coal ash is also radioactive. It contains different radium elements. So, it's really toxic, and exposure can lead to, you know, cancers, problems with major organs, reproductive issues. And that's what we're seeing now. You know, the workers who cleaned up the spill, many of them were sickened, hundreds were sickened, and I think more than 50 now have died. And we've worked really closely with some of the families. The wives in particular have been very active around trying to lift up the hazards of coal ash, because again, there is a lot of coal ash in Tennessee and many other states across the country, you know, that is currently stored in unlined pits that are leaking into the water table right next to the river, or in dry ash stacks that blow around near communities. So the wives of the Kingston workers, you know, and, you know, their husbands are sick, right? Like they're not in as good of health as the wives. And so I think that's another reason why the wives have taken a lot of it on. But you know, they've been pushing around making sure that coal ash is stored safely, but also asking for more protections for workers going forward. And so we've been also working with different communities where coal plants are shutting down, trying to help communities push for the best outcomes in terms of what happens with the coal ash, you know, in their area. And that includes both like making sure that it's stored in high and dry landfills away from people, and also that workers are protected as the coal ash is handled, is moved. But one of the big problems with protecting workers is that, one, there weren't any federal regulations over how coal ash was, you know, handled or stored until 2015. Like, it was not federally regulated at all until the coal combustion residuals rule was put in place. And another problem is that coal ash is not labeled as a hazardous waste by the EPA. It's labeled as a solid waste, which is the same as like the garbage that you take out of your kitchen. And so there are less stringent regulations over how coal ash is handled because it's not federally labeled as a hazardous waste.
I wish, listeners, you could see Marisha and I's faces. We're just like, well,
okay. Taking it back, like, we know as people that these are unsafe conditions. Like, why are these not, why are they not been taken care of?
They're in like this
conditions.
Yeah, what it's not happening? Rocket science. It's not rocket science. You would, okay. We'll continue, Bree. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah, no, I mean, I hear you. And that's, again, like coal ash, dealing with coal ash is a big part of like the transition question. And so making sure that workers are protected is something that absolutely needs to happen. And, you know, the CCR rule, the coal combustion residuals rule about like effluent limitation guidelines around coal ash and, you know, rules around how coal ash is tested and stored. Some of that got rolled back when Trump was in office. And so there's been new legislation introduced by Steve Cohen here in Tennessee trying to reinstate some of the pieces of that rule that were rolled back under Trump and also, you know, add some additional protections. But there isn't a worker safety component of that bill that was introduced by Cohen. And so I think, you know, that's something that needs to happen is some federal legislation that protects workers. But, you know, in the meantime, I'll say we've worked with some of the Kingston folks and community members to put together a list of like what are the protections that workers need to have when they're handling and cleaning up coal ash. And, you know, we've got some main categories. They want pre-procurement screenings around the contracting companies that'll be hiring the workers, coal ash safety training, better protective equipment and procedures, anti-retaliation policies, and better enforcement and regulation. And the Kingston story is really a tangled web of, you know, I just failure, honestly. And Jamie Satterfield is an investigative reporter that is here in Knoxville and works with the Knoxville News Sentinel that has uncovered a lot of the story of what happened after Kingston. And, you know, some of the workers knew that they were being poisoned, you know, like they knew that they weren't being protected and called in complaints with OSHA, and OSHA didn't investigate. You know, they called in a complaint and I think OSHA may have sent someone out from their field office, but the person who came didn't even speak with a worker. They just talked to the contracting company, Jacobs, when they came out to visit. So, you know, and there's a thing that happens when federal agencies are tasked with regulating other federal agencies. You know, sometimes I think it's easy for them to give each other a pass, you know, like they don't really hold each other accountable. So I think that's part of what happened at Kingston and with TVA. But a lot of this needs to change going forward because, again, there's a lot of coal plants being closed down, a lot of coal ash being moved. Actually, in North Carolina, I think all of the Duke ash is being cleaned up. And our colleague, Amy Adams, has some history working around that, but it's just important that worker protections are put in place federally, and also that the unions that represent workers moving coal ash are informed about, like, you know, what the hazards are and what proper safety procedures are. You know, those sort of resources need to be deployed immediately while we're waiting for federal regulation.
Hey y'all, I've got to hop off here. I wanted to respond to something though, just real briefly.
Please do. Please.
just, you know, Ed Bree was telling y'all kind of the story, and the reaction, the understandable reaction is kind of like, well, how can they get away with it? And yeah. Because we let them, you know, that's why any of this happens, is because we let them. And so Bree and I, you know, are kind of talking with you about two things, really. We're talking about actions that need to happen, whether that's some kind of regulatory enforcement or a policy change. That's one thing. But the other thing we're talking about is building power. And that's the only thing you can do to not just let this stuff happen, is to build power among the people who are impacted by these issues and the people who care about those people and the people on whose behalf coal is being mined or burnt or whatever. So all of us, you know, it's to build power among those people that the decision makers have to answer to. So that's what we're trying to do as Appalachian Voices, in partnership with the coal miners through the Black Lung Association, and in partnership with the Kingston workers and their families through the organizing work that Bree's doing. I hope that's the work that your listeners are all trying to do in their communities, in whatever, on whatever issues and in whatever ways speak to them.
Hi, listener. My name is Alex Easdale, and I'm the Executive Director of the Southeast Climate and Energy Network, or SEN. SEN is a 70-plus member network organization that stretches across the Southeast and the island of Puerto Rico. We work at the intersection of clean energy, environmental protection, and climate justice. At SEN, we envision the Southeastern United States as a leading region for just, equitable, and inclusive solutions to the climate crisis. We aim to confront this climate crisis by creating strategic alignment, growing capacity, and building power among member organizations and their communities in the Southeast. To effectively collaborate across diverse states and issue areas, we provide leadership, training, funding, and rapid response support to all of our members. However, we cannot do this without your help. To donate, please go directly to www.sen-us.org. That is SCEN-US.org, and help us build healthy, resilient, and vibrant communities. We really hope you enjoyed this episode.
But that directly leads into our next question.
Right. So I'm just going to back up from what Willie said. So a lot of miners are kept in unsafe environments and unsafe conditions or whatnot, but it's impossible to just stop the mining industry altogether. So how do we assure that these workers are safe? How do we ensure, like, as we transfer transition into a clean energy and a clean energy world, how do we ensure that they're not left behind?
That's a good question. And I can't speak to, like, I think all of the mining issues that Willie knows a lot about. But I think, you know, in terms of like workers that are moving coal ash, and many of those workers are represented by the laborers union, the Teamsters, and the operating engineers. Again, it's making sure that we have the right regulations to ensure their safety. It's also, you know, one of the things that we've been doing recently is speaking, you know, we've been working with different sort of labor justice folks and field organizers from unions to talk with their international safety and health directors about bringing in trainings for workers and community members around, you know, how to safely handle coal ash. So that's one of the things we're working on in the meantime. And honestly, Willie is, Willie's such a good talker, but I think what he said is right. Like building power.
Yeah, he doesn't give himself enough credit.
Yeah. Yeah. Building power and building solidarity, right? Like, even if environmental groups don't see a clear, like, clean energy goal out of building partnerships around worker safety for workers that are cleaning up coal ash, you know, or are still in the mines, you know, it's like, that's the kind of solidarity that we need to be building, because it is a responsibility, you know, from an equity perspective and an environmental justice perspective. Like, it is our responsibility to take up these issues and stand in solidarity with these workers.
I love that. And
I think that's a message that often gets like misconstrued or miscommunicated. And that's partly from like the environmental world's like fault of leaving people out. Cause a lot of these workers are like, you know, blue collar, white conservative men for the most part, right?
Yeah, I think, I mean, yeah. That is, depending on where you're at, that's definitely true. I mean, it's certainly true of a lot of the unions, at least on the trade mm-hmm. side that I work with here in, like, you know, the TBA area, is a lot of them can be, you know, white conservative, often men that make.
Yeah. And they need to know that, like, we're doing this to make sure they're safe and taken care of. And like, we don't want them to be left behind, and we don't want their families, we want them to be able to have good paying safe jobs in the long run. And showing solidarity with them, I think, is so important.
It is important. And I think, you know, from the environmental group perspective, I think a lot of mistakes that environmental groups make is that there's going to be some sort of one-to-one job replacement when the energy transition happens, like mm-hmm. like miners, or, you know, the Teamsters who are hauling coal ash are going to be the ones who are installing solar panels. And to be quite yeah. frank, it's not going to be a one-to-one replacement, you know, like
exactly.
a lot of at least small scale solar, distributed solar, and well, even utility scale and energy efficiency, like those sorts of jobs, you know, are often lower skilled jobs. And also they're lower paying because many of them are not represented by unions and they don't have collective bargaining rights, which it needs to be another part of the energy transition and focus for environmental groups, is making sure that clean energy workers have collective bargaining rights. But we also need to make sure that, you know, existing energy workers, you know, including the ones who are working in the mines, the ones who are working around coal ash, have the chance, you know, to retire early with full pension and full benefits if that's what they want to do, that there is paid job training if they do want to go into a new job and it requires some training, making sure that they're paid a full salary to do that. You know, there are things that we can do to support that transition, but, you know, for now it's like, it's following the lead of workers who have been impacted and, you know, been, you know, driving forward the push to try to get better regulations in place and protect workers from the harm, you know, that they've seen in these jobs. So I think, you know, standing in solidarity with them means like taking their lead and showing up when they're calling for support. So, and they do need support, right? Like fighting these big utilities is, you know, we all know.
Oh yeah. It's not easy. Yeah.
At all.
Well, I love that. And I kind of, so I want to end this episode with a hopeful question, because like this, you know, it is a David versus Goliath situation here that we're dealing with. And y'all are doing such amazing work with helping these people, making sure they're taken care of, and also fighting for policy too. So I imagine, like Willie mentioned, that thing that changes every year, that like tax is up for debate every year. Good Lord, that's exhausting. How do y'all have time for that? But so I want to end on this with, what gives y'all hope? What keeps y'all fighting?
Well, I'd be interested to hear what Willie would say to this.
Yeah, I'll just hit him up directly. Give me his number. I'll call him.
Yeah, right. Well, I think, you know, what gives me hope is, in a lot of cases, it's just the people that I'm working with. You know, it's building relationship with folks from different walks of life and who have had different experiences. And, you know, the women whose husbands have gone through, you know, been dealing with terrible chronic illnesses for years and are dying, you know, and have died, you know, that those women continue to show up and fight for workers' rights and fight for other communities to protect them from, you know, the same fate that they've had. Like, that gives me a lot of hope, is that people are resilient, you know, and that just unusual friendships and alliances are being made, you know, in order to fight for a better future. So that sounds kind of hokey, but it's the people, you know?
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.